Hi, I'm Keegan, and this is A Bunch of Gamers. Gonna be talking about Legacy Werewolf today. I apologize if my voice sounds a little weird, sick, but I knew if I didn't record this soon, I'd never get it recorded. So, as most people know, I'm not a big fan of Werewolf 5th. I'm more of a Legacy person. And that said, there are absolutely problems with Legacy Werewolf, and these are some of the retcons and house rules I've used to introduce new players and get the setting into a place that I like. And so we'll start with the retcons. Retcons are just what I'm calling setting and changing terms. These are things I've added to the history of Werewolf, things I've removed or replaced. I feel it's pretty easy to understand. And we'll start with the Krynos breed. The original name of the breed is a little messed up. It is either related to an actual group of indigenous people here in North America, or you could make the argument, and some of the books did, that it was based on the Latin root word, which meant half-breed. Both have kind of negative connotations, though the half-breed one makes some sort of sense in lore, but if you have to spend 15-20 minutes with a new player going, no, it doesn't mean the racist thing, it's probably best to just change it. So I brought it in line with everything else. Hamid breed Garu are called Hamid because they are born in their Hamid form. Lupus breed Garu are the same way, so I go with Krynos for those born in Krynos form. It's just smoother, it makes sense, and it doesn't use either a real group of people or a word that could be misconstrued as a real world of people to describe inbred werewolf babies. Speaking of the Krynos breed, instead of deformity, I'd go with affliction or mutation. In the case of horns and hooves, things like that. Once again, it's been over 30 years since the game was written, and it's just time to update a few things. Patrons. So instead of totem, which is appropriative, I go with patron, just like Werewolf 5th did. Purebreed. Changed to legacy, as many Garu are capable of choosing their tribe outside of their ancestry. And the legacy is how many of your ancestors chose to participate in that particular tribe rather than some weird blood purity thing. Now, we'll get to the tribes. So I'm just going to hit a few quick ones here since a few things I updated the tribes with either are in my current game or I have continued to muse on things and these are things I would update for future games. Black Furies. Pretty basic changes here. Introduce more elements here of modern feminist thinking, along with some of the Fury's own ideas on gender based on it being spiritual, physical, and social. Fury's accept trans women and non-binary Garu, but they don't accept trans men Garu as they view them as men. And this is an intentional blind spot for players to push against. Add some intersectional thoughts, which create stronger bonds or at least alliances between the Black Furies and the two brother tribes, and get rid of the turf stuff being even remotely mainstream with the Furies. I think turf Furies could work as an antagonist camp, like you have with the Man-Eaters in the Bonar tribe or the Eaters of the Dead with the Silent Striders, but it's close enough to real-world bigotry that some of my players might have to deal with in their everyday lives, that it would be a very much a session zero conversation in my games before that camp even came into existence. That said, mainstream Furies do believe gender is a spectrum, and as a tribe dedicated to the wild, most believe that strict gender binary only strengthens the weaver. They believe that the concept of patriarchy was derived by humanity, but the system has only strengthened the weaver and the worm. Strict rules and caste systems and categorizations of gender to the weaver and the domination of other genders and the concept of love into control fall to the worm. Finally, the Furies accept any of the Krynos breed, not because of their patron, but because their nature falls outside of the binary. They are sterile, hated, and strongly encouraged to be asexual or celibate regardless of their sexual orientation or
gender identity.
To many Furies and their patron, this is just another class of gender, as there are strict norms for the Krynos in sex and gender expression. Bonars. Mostly just removing a lot of the Lost Cause shit from their tribe book. revised tribe books specifically. I know that stuff was really popular in the 90s and early 2000s, but it's been over 20 years and we know it's bullshit. I have a hard time swallowing also that Rat and the lowest of the low tribe of Bonars wouldn't be abolitionists against slavery. In Modern Nights, I've been cranking up the anti-capitalist sentiments of the Bonars and that they view connection and community in the face of oppression and hyper-individuality as a form of finding the wild within the Weaver. This in turn helps explain the restriction on resources. It's not that the Bonars choose to be homeless per se, at least not all of them, but they reject capitalism and the grind set, and instead, when they do make money, they reinvest it within their community via mutual aid. The Bonars also have a high percentage of marginalized people in them, as marginalized people such as LGBTQ plus individuals and most other minorities, black, those of Hispanic descent, things like that, are statistically more likely to be homeless in the United States, and that is another reason they rage against the system that puts them and their kin in these situations. All this leads to a potential flaw in the tribe that's worth exploring, what I deemed the Rat King. And what I mean by this is because they are so tied to the people they protect, their constant need to self-sacrifice means that they might get their tails tied together, so to speak, and end up killing the whole nest. Children of Gaia. So the children are still all about unifying the Garu. However, in my games, they tend to be more politically savvy in terms of manipulating others. I also play up their desire to overlook the atrocities of the past for the sake of a unified Garu nation today. This gives them a flaw beyond hippie that you typically see in a lot of other games, and sometimes even the books themselves. This in many ways makes them kind of a shitlib of the Garu nation. They're so caught up in the there's no race but the human race rhetoric, but for the Garu instead, and they ignore some of the harms caused to other tribes, especially the brothers, and are so focused on unity, many take the stance of, we said sorry, it's time to move on, which creates a flaw within the tribe culture that the players can push against. Finally, they are more willing to commit violence against human infrastructure.
Taking the anti-consumerism message of the hippies that the Children of Gaia were based on, and mixing in the rage,
makes for a tribe that wishes to crush creatures of the worm.
The tribe ends up not viewing property damage as actual violence, as violence is only doled out to creatures of the worm, living, breathing creatures or spirits that can be harmed by their claws.
And so they are more willing to attack and destroy infrastructure to combat the worm, the Fianna. This is already canon in revised edition, but I would shine more of a light on the diverse Celtic nature of the Fianna. Fianna in Central Europe being different than the Fianna of Ireland. This means that some Fianna would have different names for some of their gifts in the core book. An example being such as Fairy Light for the Irish and American Fianna could be called the Gleam of Maponos for Fianna that have closer connections to Gaul. This would also then extend to their camps, which we will see mirrored in a few of the other tribes, where the camps of the Fianna represent specific storytelling traditions as well as connections to specific Celtic groups or traditions. Now, the Irish Celt is considered the default of many other tribes, and they don't have a specific camp because of the Irish diaspora. This means, in theory, that this specific branch of the Fianna has moved far and wide and is all over the world and have tied themselves with the base tribe, thus losing the need for a camp, as well as possibly absorbing other cultural markers, such as how Irish American are culturally different from Irish people still in Ireland, and finding the need to create a specific cultural identity is no longer needed for them. These cultural camps, for lack of a better word, are quite important in places like the Iberian Peninsula, France, and the like, because of the Romanization of Celts on continental Europe. This would have been a way for the Fianna to preserve their mother culture as it was destroyed in human societies. A big thematic focus of the Fianna is how they were once oppressed and pushed out of their many home septs, only to turn around and do it globally to the brother tribes, to the Bunyip, and the Pharaoh of South America, and how they live with a kind of cognitive dissonance regarding that, where they talk about how they were pushed out of many of their own Karens in Europe, while singing also about their Western expansion and the Karens that they hold in Australia, etc., where they were once considered targets in Europe, have now become enmeshed with the cultures of European Garu, especially abroad. The Geta Fenris. It might be shocking to hear that I don't change the Fenrir a lot from their incarnations in the Revised Tribe book. I think the Killing of the Swords was a good story beat. I think the only thing I sometimes expand upon is how unique their brand of might makes right is, as James Sombrano said in the GM talks regarding Werewolf 5th. The Fenrir believe discrimination on disability, race, sexual orientation, or gender identity makes one weak. It creates a blind spot in terms of allies finding strength and can make one underestimate their opponents. Glasswalkers. I've pulled from the ideas of James's Patreon, link down below. The one idea that really clicked for me was that the Glasswalkers believe that the unbridled chaos of the wild is what caused the madness in the Weaver and thus caused her to capture the worm. I just love the idea and think that it's a great idea that creates an interesting theological conflict within Werewolf that isn't just Black Spiral Dancers who think worm is good and Glasswalkers who think Weaver is just okay. Red Talons. No major changes. Go read Red Talons Revised. Shadow Lords. For the Shadow Lords, I try and make it a bit more explicit that the Shadow Lords have never attempted to really take over the nation until very recently. The Shadow Lords have always seen themselves as the tribe that does things others would frown upon to get things done, and that they have always made a show of trying to take over the nation to push the Silverfangs to be the best leaders that they could be. Silverfangs. As I change things with Purebreed, and I change it for the Silverfangs, calling it Ancestry instead of Legacy, just because they have more of an aristocracy view on things. The Silverfangs are like a college, and they pull from Legacy graduates from within their own tribes. They will occasionally attempt to snipe those from other tribes. This gives more validity to the Black Fury legend in Revised Edition regarding Silverfangs with black fur, who were male Garu of the Fury tribe. This in turn means that the Silverfang madness is more spiritual and situational rather than inbreeding. The Silverfangs know, as leaders, how fucked up the world is. They know that it is, at least in part, their fault. They ordered the War of Rage. They are the reason they have no more allies. And they see how impossible the coming apocalypse is. And they are driven to madness or into Hirano because of it. No major changes to the Silent Striders. Stargazers. Similar to the Fianna, I would expand the Stargazers' cultural baseline to have more influences from the continent, and they would actually have a higher population than in the base game because Asia is large. In the original canon, they have influences from China, Mongolia, Korea, India, and Japan, and those are vastly different cultures. The Stargazers have camps that put a spotlight on those individual influences. Pulling from Werewolf 20th, I'd have specific camps of Stargazers having one foot in the door with the Beast Courts and the Henge Yokai, and other camps being closer to the Garu Nation. This could be leveraged for metaplot purposes. If the Stargazers leave, it's that that particular camp has decided to cut its ties to the Garu Nation. Because the nation only interacted with such a small fraction of the Stargazers, it explains why they were thought of as so rare. Pulling from their first edition tribe book, I like the idea that the Stargazer tribe have come to view the Weaver as the true enemy, and that her endless stasis could bring ruin to the world, and that the worm is simply a symptom of that problem. The Brother tribe in general. Now, some keen-eared listeners might have noticed that I have not been using the original names for these tribes. The names are basically appropriative, and in the case of Younger Brother, the original name is outright offensive, so I'm going to be using Younger, Older, and Middle Brother in my games and when I talk about the tribes here. That said, I think alternative names can also work, so if you're taking a page from the work done by James Sombrano, I'd use Winter's Teeth for Younger Brother, stealing from Josh Heath in High Level Games. Older Brother would be called the Bane Tenders. And Middle Brother, I'd go with something like Mountain Walkers, given their association with the Earth. Next, as a general rule, I have decided on the three brother tribes originally being closer akin to being Garu nations in and of themselves, with each brother having a specific triadic focus. From first edition Werewolf, it's suggested that there were multiple indigenous tribes of Garu in the Americas, and that they unified into the two remaining tribes as a matter of survival. I wanted to keep that element as it makes a lot of sense given that there's over 10 tribes for Europe, but only 3 for America. Hence the logic of the brothers being nations before they were tribes. Older Brother. The collection of tribes that eventually became Older Brother viewed themselves as the uncorrupted weaver in the Dawn Times. This is how Older Brother crafted the Rite of Bane Tending, using the weaver's webs to capture banes. Like the Fionn and the Stargazers, the camps of Older Brother would draw from the before-mentioned previous tribes that comprised the nation, and their camps, along with Younger Brother, would be unique in that they would have a secondary patron for these camps, those patrons being from the previous tribes.
The loss of Middle Brother and the horrors of colonization had forced
Older Brother to adapt and evolve. Believing the loss of Middle Brother unbalanced both them and Younger Brother, they now strive to embody balance within their own tribe, rejecting some traditions and expanding their purview to indigenous cultures globally, as well as subjugated peoples as a way to preserve tradition and expand upon them for land management and decolonial projects. They walk the balance of preserving the old and adopting and absorbing the new while fighting against hegemonic norms of European settler colonialism. Obviously, I am not a person to really expand upon these ideas beyond my own personal games, and this framework was somewhat present in the tribe's tribal book. I mostly tied them to the triad and brought them back into comprising multiple tribes. Younger Brother. The collection of tribes that would become Younger Brother were the nation connected closer to the wild, innovative in terms of land management, combat, etc. When Middle Brother fell, Younger Brother refined themselves to keep tradition alive. Witnessing the apocalypse that was colonialization and Western expansion, the tribe felt a responsibility to protecting the human cultures that many had come from. They have found their own balance, but this has driven a wedge between them and Older Brother that didn't exist before, as their ideologies are compatible, but disagreements still exist, and the purview of only one member of the triad no longer being used to explain away those differences. Just as before, I wouldn't feel comfortable reinforcing anything beyond these broad strokes of Younger Brother, as I am not indigenous, and their camps would resemble the previous tribes that made up of what Younger Brother was, and those camps would also have a secondary patron. Middle Brother. They're not playable. The one thing I want to add is that Middle Brother did die sacrificing themselves to put down the Eater of Souls. Middle Brother represents the balance worm between the three Dawn Nations, a term I've taken from Werewolf the Essentials, which there will be a link to that Tumblr below. I got this idea of linking the brothers to the Triad based on some passages I had read from the Croatan song a few years ago, with a myth of how the Triadic Worm was compared to the three brothers in that book, and how the three heads of the worm are compared to the Triad in the Book of the Worm. The Garu Nation's politics. In my setting, I play up North America having separate and distinct conflicts than Europe, where tribes are more willing to work with other tribes due to the Storm Eater, which was kind of a flashpoint, and a vision of what could happen if the nation failed. Thus, the conflict between European tribes is more muted, but there's still conflict between European and indigenous tribes of Garu. This is because there are still disagreements on equity and equality, with many of the European tribes trying to argue that more can't be given up if they are to be successful against the worm, and the two brother tribes rightfully calling them out on that bullshit. Meanwhile, in Europe, the only real flashpoints have been the fall of the White Howlers, which was predominantly a Fianna and Fenrir conflict, and many human conflicts. Thus, a powerful worm beast didn't really unify them in the same way. This creates a more fractured Europe in many ways, but has unified in others. I play this up in that there aren't many multi-tribal septs in Europe, but there are a surprising number of multi-tribal packs who travel from Karen to Karen before splitting up and finding their own homes, typically amongst their own tribes. And the few multi-tribal septs that do exist in Europe are found in places of cultural overlap, with the exception of the Children of Gaia, who tend to have at least a few representatives in everyone's Karens. Garu religious differences. Who came first? In the core legacy game, it is assumed that each Pharah have their own views on who came first, Gaia or the Triad. For the Garu, it was always assumed that Gaia created the Triad, and in my home games, a large number of the nations still believe that, about 70% or so. However, the remaining 30% believe that the Triad created Gaia. This religious minority has representatives in all tribes, to a greater or lesser extent, but three tribes in particular are more likely to believe that the Triad came first. The first are the two brothers, with a large number of interactions between the Pharah. The brothers learned a few of their myths and incorporated them into their own before the arrival of European Garu. These religious differences were used as justification by European Garu for their conquest, despite having some of their own tribal members with similar views. The other tribe is, to some surprisingly so, the Glasswalkers, who tend to use this as a justification for reforming the Weaver against the Worm, as she is more powerful than Gaia. Most Glasswalkers believe that the Triad is the universe and Gaia is just a Celestian. I will add that, while they are not the majority of the tribe, a large number of Children of Gaia believe that the Triad came first, about 40% of the tribe, which the tribe uses to try and craft alliances with a shared belief system, especially among the Glasswalkers and two brother tribes. The source of the imbalance. There is a pretty even split between two major schools of thought regarding who went mad first, the Worm or the Weaver. What might surprise some is that the Red Talons believe that the Worm went mad first, something that few tribes would assume. However, they argue that humanity learned from the Worm and corrupted branches and stones to create spears and arrows and other weapons to grow beyond their station. The Weaver became interested in humanity later. The Stargazers are the tribe that most prominently believe the Weaver went mad first. They argue that the complete disconnection between the Umbra and the physical world is proof that she had been shaping and changing the world in her own mad spinning, and the Worm was captured and driven mad for attempting to restore balance. The Umbra, and more importantly, the general Umbra. I do like a more dangerous Umbra, And I don't think guy in spirit equals helpful is all that great for the setting and creates kind of a Garu-centric universe. Now, the books don't necessarily say that, but it's been, in my experience, a predominant misconception in the fan base, so I just wanted to say it's not the case in my games. Spirits are concepts given life and must act out on those concepts and bands. And despite my general dislike of Werewolf 5th, I think the thoughts and feelings and fears of animals having a direct effect on the Umbra is a great idea, and would implement that as well. I think it decentralizes human experience and its importance in the world, which is kind of a major thing for Werewolf. And especially the Red Talons and Lupus of other tribes have more ground to stand on when talking about ecological destruction beyond the obvious loss of a forest, the Near Realms. In addition, there was something from the Henge Yokai book that I would want to expand upon. In that book, it lists Near Realms that are known to the various changing breeds of East Asia. This is because they have a certain cultural context to get there that Western changers lack, and vice versa. This gives additional context to why the White Howlers fell, and adds an additional umbral consequence to colonization. Let me explain. As the Roman Empire expanded and subjugated the people of Europe, they brought with them Roman values that would erode the cultures of those they conquered. Losing this cultural context, entire realms in the Near Umbra would start to disappear over generations, or even rapidly, depending on the victims. This makes the White Howler's desperation make a lot more sense. The Picts don't exist. We know very little about their culture, and the realms that would have been informed by that culture are now lost forever. This, of course, also goes on to why things were so desperate for the brother tribes, and why colonization is such a flashpoint apocalyptic event for those tribes, potentially, if that was something a storyteller and their players wanted to expand upon. And I'm sure there are other setting changes I've made or would continue to make, but this script's already getting a little long, and I think it's time to move on to mechanics. I'll drop a Google Doc sheet in the description for the changes for any of those who are interested for quick reference. Hopefully this section's a bit shorter, but I do have a few quick rule changes that should help speed up combat if I ever ran this in the future and make the game a bit easier. I'll also include a bit of my extended prelude, which was not captured in the actual play, but these are rules I have historically used to ramp up new people into the setting who have no background knowledge in Werewolf, general. In future games, I'd remove the one subtract successes, and that botches only happen if you roll a 1 and no successes. I'd switch from the 20th rule set of 2 successes for 10s rolled with an attribute or ability with a specialty, and switch back to 10s explode, and reroll until you stop getting 10s. I ignore the rule where every point of rage above your willpower causes a -1 on social rolls. The exception to this rule is with humans that fall under the curse. If the human or animal's willpower is lower than your character's rage, this penalty applies. This way it kind of codifies the curse beyond vibes. I'd also add a stunt mechanic similar to Exalted. Descriptions that make the situation more interesting can gain between 1 to 3 dice based on storyteller approval. Now, just to reiterate, and this is brought up in Exalted, interesting does not mean cooler, though it can, but like switching tactics in a negotiation and using intimidation and describing the threats would likely get more stunt dice from me than a very long, impassioned speech of heroics if it didn't fall in line with who that character was in general, or the audience didn't seem like they'd be that receptive based on contextual clues given to the players. I don't want Exalted style over-the-top action, but I want more visceral descriptions that would fit the vibe of Werewolf. Combat. Instead of a declaration phase, players would have their dodge or parry values, which we'll get into in a moment, and they can activate a defensive action, once again, we'll get to in a moment, to improve their dodge values. So instead of declaring a dodge, players would have a dodge value equal to their dexterity plus athletics divided by 2, round down to a minimum of 1. So if my Arun had 6 dexterity and 5 athletics in Krynos form, they would have a dodge score of 5. If my Thurge only had 1 dexterity and no athletics, their dodge value would be 1, not 0. Parry follows the same rules as dodge, just replace athletics with brawl or melee, depending on the situation. Brawl can't parry blades or ranged attacks, obviously. And blades can't parry ranged attacks, once again, obviously. Agaru could potentially parry a blade in Glabro, Krynos, or Hispo form if the blade is not made of silver, because I think it looks cool and it makes sense given that they have a natural soak to these sorts of things. Players gain rollover damage for each success over the dodge value. Players can use their action to defend. To defend, the player must roll their dexterity plus athletics at a difficulty 6 and add that score to their dodge value for the remainder of the round. Rage can be spent on defensive actions. Every attack against the character reduces their dodge by 1. If attacked 5 times, the attack assumes a dodge score of 0 unless a dodge action is taken. I've never used the rage for extra action limits found in the 20th anniversary core book, where the player can only take a number of extra actions equal to their dexterity or wits, whichever is lower, unless frenzying, then it's their dexterity, or take a penalty. If you have the rage, just go for it. And same thing with rage actions that you hear in the podcast. Rage actions do not happen at the end of the round. They happen on your turn just to make things quick and easy. Regeneration. I would have the players regenerate 2 bashing or 1 lethal per turn with no roll required. I would update the gift combat healing to heal 4 levels of bashing or 2 levels of lethal per turn with no roll required. They can attempt to heal 1 aggravated level of damage from any source other than silver with a stamina roll of diff 8. Auspices. Finally, I would give each auspice a default power on top of their normal auspice gift. Some gifts are so obvious that they're must-haves for a specific auspice, and instead of creating an experience sink, the players just get these powers immediately after their first change. So the Arun would start play with Resist Pain. It just makes sense for a warrior auspice. All Galliards would start with Call of the Wild. They should be able to howl further for moots. Philodoxes would start with Persuasion, given that they are the judge and negotiators of the nation. All Thurges would start with Spirit Speech. You're just a bad Thurge if you can't talk to most spirits, and everyone takes this one at character creation nearly all of the time if they've played more than one Chronicle. The Ragabosh will get Blur of the Milky Eye. Once again, everyone takes this when they're a Ragabosh in my experience, so just give it to them so that they have more options or less obvious choices when they first create their character. Character creation house rules. From Werewolf the Essentials, I'm taking the point spend changes from them. Players have 15 dots to spend amongst their 9 attributes and 27 dots to spend amongst their abilities, with no ability being allowed over 3 without freebie points. My last rule is that Hamadgaru cannot buy Primal Urge unless it's with freebie points. Extended Prelude. This is a method I've used for a few games to ramp up new players, to get them acclimated to the lore of Werewolf the Apocalypse without giving them pages upon pages to read. There are unstructured ways of doing this given in the revised core book and the revised storyteller's handbook, and I'm just expanding upon them. Players will select their breed and auspice, but will not select their tribe yet. Players will also not spend their freebie points, with the exception of some approved merits, like being ambidextrous and things like that. Players are not required to spend all their background dots at this time, though they are allowed to do so if they wish. Players can put dots into Legacy and hint at what tribe they want, or if they trust you, you as the storyteller can pick behind the scenes. As the player goes through learning who their character is, they can choose a different tribe, and they will lose these dots and legacies, and they will be refunded in background points. Players begin with 2 willpower. before the rite of passage. I then run the game for about 1 to 2 sessions where their characters and players learn some of the basic lore of Werewolf the Apocalypse at the same time, interacting with NPCs such as the Den Parent, perhaps have a minor crisis at the Sept to let them try out their abilities and how they want to play, etc. During these role-playing moments, players are able to invest their freebie points to correlate with the training their characters are receiving. Once this is complete, the characters can run through the rite of passage, where they go to the tribe they want to join, petition to join, and that can be used by the storyteller to customize the rite of passage. They are given, once the rite of passage is done, they are given their tribe, they spend the remaining freebie points, and in addition, the character's willpower score increases, even if they've spent freebie points. Tribes that start with 3 willpower increase the character's willpower by 1, tribes with 4 willpower increase the score by 2, and the stargazers will increase it by 3. Once the rite of passage is complete, the players can then go through the rite of patron, where they find their pack patron. How I run is the players do not need to have the patron background to earn a patron that fits them and their character's personalities as they move through the Umbra. However, if they don't have the points needed, they cannot spend experience on anything else but the patron background until they have the total amount of points between them. Until that time, they must follow the ban of their patron and only get a fraction of the power. I reduce the number of dice they get, they don't get access to special gifts granted by the patron, or that gift is limited to only once per day if that is the only benefit gifted by the patron. And those are my house rules. They're pretty simple. They might be a little more involved. And these ones I can vouch for more because these are house rules I have used before. Unlike the Werewolf 5th ones, which were musings based on problems I saw running Werewolf 5th. So if you like these kinds of things from me, leave a comment on other house rules that you like, that you've done, or things you'd like me to talk about more in the future regarding either the World of Darkness or some other RPG. And if I haven't played it, then maybe I'll give it a read. Until then, I'll see you in the next one. Bye.